From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Kevin Wade is my guest. He's written a lot of great things, movies, plays, television shows. I have spent untold hours with his work, and you probably have too, as we will see. Now he has an excellent and exciting novel. It's called Johnny Careless. Kevin Wade, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I love the book, and I highly recommend it to fans of police procedurals like, say, Blue Bloods. That was a good show.
Yeah.
I like that show a lot, as a matter of fact, and I want to talk to you about that. But if you don't mind, I want to start with one of my all-time favorite movies, which is Working Girl.
Thanks.
And you wrote it.
Yes,
I did. Let's, if you don't mind, I want to know all about it. How was it to work with Mike Nichols? Was he wonderful to work with, horrible to work with? Which?
Absolutely wonderful. I was, I think, 31 when I started working with Mike. He had a schedule that was backed up, so we had about a year's waiting time before we were going to shoot the movie. So instead of starting prep 3 months early, he started prep about 9 months early with me. So that he could teach this first-time screenwriter what it was to kind of take the good raw material, which he'd signed on to do, and make it into something that could be a Mike Nichols film. So I kind of went to Mike Nichols University for 6 months.
Wow, that's neat. So the idea for Working Girl was his, yours?
It was mine. It was a script, an idea that I developed with a producer named Doug Wick, who was also a first time. He'd worked with Alan Pakula, and Doug went on to do Gladiator 1 and 2 and Memoirs of a Gangster and a million other movies, and is an Academy Award winner for Gladiator. I used to ride a bicycle around New York a lot, and the tip of Manhattan was a very good biking area. And I would see the Staten Island Ferry coming over, and those hordes of secretaries pouring off with their big hair and their accents. And you needed only to direct your eyes about 7 degrees to the right to see Ellis Island. And it occurred to me one day, not a light bulb, just kind of like, oh, if you put those two things together, these are immigrants coming into the United States, the land of milk and honey and opportunity. And let's make this secretary the Horatio Alger of this story.
It's a pretty feminist movie.
I guess in the rearview mirror, because at the time, and I don't have a recordings of it, but it seems to me when I'd be on panels or be whatever it was where I was invited to talk about the movie, a lot of people in the audience, and I will say mostly women, took great issue with that she had a little baby doll voice, that she was getting drunk at a bar, picking a guy up, that she was imitating her boss, and that the boss was, as they would put it, just a woman, just a man in woman's clothing, the way her character was drawn. So it wasn't until later, way later in life, that anyone said, oh, that was kind of forward thinking about women.
Well, no, I can't remember exactly, but I think Sigourney Weaver got an Oscar nomination, didn't she?
She certainly did, and well deserved.
She's amazing. After you were writing the film for several months, were you involved then in the shooting of the film?
I was involved in the shooting of the film, and that I was cordially invited on by Mike, who had kind of very generously said, let's show you the whole soup to nuts. So I was on it for a little bit, which was great fun. I'd been a playwright, but to have to go down to the set and see the entire Staten Island Ferry and 1,000 extras emptying off, being filmed by, let's say, 3 cameras and a crew of 150, all of from a paragraph that you wrote on a page of paper was astonishing to me. There was a Writers Guild strike in the middle of it in 2008, so I had to stay away from the set. And but the editor, a wonderful and gifted guy named Sam Osteen, also invited me into his little studio and showed me how close his job was to my job. I told the story in words, and he told it in the pictures that he had.
Interesting. And now it's going to be a musical. They're writing a musical. Are you involved in the musical of it?
I'm involved only as like a grandfather at like grandparents' day at school. So I'm
Cyndi Lauper
invited
wrote
to
the music.
things.
Is that right? Cyndi Lauper wrote the music?
Cyndi Lauper wrote the music and lyrics. I've been around it for forever, and I met Cyndi probably 9 or 10 years ago when she started working on it. And then an acquaintance and a friend, Teresa Rebeck, was eventually hired to write the book, an enormously talented playwright who also created the TV show Smash, so got a little taste of the musical theater as well. They've done an incredible job as the grandparent. They go up at the La Jolla Playhouse in the fall, I think, with an eye towards a Broadway run.
Well, I mean, I think it's much better for you to look at it and say it's great rather than, oh man, they messed up my story.
100%. But and early on they'd said, well, why don't you write the book? And I thought about it for about 90 seconds and thought, A, I have no idea how to write the book of a musical, and B, I already wrote this once and people liked it, and so why mess with that? So they along with the director have reimagined it, and I'll just leave it there. I think they have a wonderful thing going that has something to do with the movie, but is not a film to stage translation.
Well, I think it's a great movie, and I think it's going to go far. Congratulations,
Thanks.
Working Girl.
We'll
Maybe
see.
the last to congratulate you on writing Working Girl.
That's right.
Well, you said you'd written plays before then. How did you get started as a writer, and know that writing was going to be your trade, your profession?
I dropped out of college when I was 19. I was like a th quasi theater major, in that theater was the only classes that I actually went to. And I dropped out of college, moved to New York to become an actor. But New York mostly cast me as a bartender. I took classes. I was in some off Broadway plays and very, very low budget movies. And by the time I was about 25, my talent was not advancing and my hairline was receding. And I thought I need something else to do. And the thought after that was, I've been in some really bad plays and it looked like the playwright was having a good time. I'll try writing a play. And I did that in short order. On nights off from my bartending gig, and it was called Key Exchange, and audiences liked it, and as it turned out, the critics did, and it moved to like a 2 year off Broadway run. So I had a job as a playwright one morning.
And you've written a lot of television, but Blue Bloods is the thing, I guess, that people might know you because your name is on every episode or most of the
Yeah,
episodes.
television. Prior to that, I'd written 8 episodes of a series that did not succeed and was mercifully interrupted by a writer's strike in 2008 called Kashmir Mafia. And I was so Blue Bloods and all 293 episodes of it almost had my grubby little fingerprints all over it.
Well, Robin Green has been a guest on the show a couple of times, and she was one of the creators of Blue
Oh
Bloods.
yeah, she and her partner Mitch wrote the pilot and were around the first season.
She's a wonderful person.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I want to. So I've seen every episode because I hadn't seen any episodes. But when I was going to talk with Robin, I thought, well, I better watch one. So I got the DVD set of season one, and I watched the first episode, and then within a few months, I'd watched absolutely every episode. And at that point, you were at like 7 or 8 episodes.
I think you get a set of steak knives for that or something. I forget what the prize
Thank you. But
is.
so not only have I watched every episode, but the other night when I knew that I would be speaking to you, I watched My Aim Is True, which was the final episode of season 8, for which you were nominated for an award or won an award or something.
Yeah, I was nominated for an Edgar Award, the mystery writers thing.
And it made me think of a lot of questions that I want to ask a showrunner, which I've never had an opportunity to ask before. Well, that's not true. The late Jerry Ludwig was the showrunner on the original MacGyver. So I've talked to him a lot, and he was on the show. He's a lovely guy. But I was watching that episode, and it's a wonderful episode, and it's a pivotal story episode, as well as being a very well-written and I mean, I think I cried a couple of times. It was really, really a lovely episode.
Thank you.
So I want to know, are you in, as the showrunner, how do you decide what's going to happen, not in each episode, but in the overarching arc of a season or multiple seasons?
That's a good question. I'll try to be very brief and have at least a decent answer. First of all, showrunner is a made-up term. It doesn't exist in any contract. It was made up by some reporter in the 1990s to basically make a king on the television show. In reality, the showrunner is the head writer. Sometimes when he's written the pilot and created the show, Mike White is a showrunner. David Chase was a showrunner, as well as being the auteur of those White Lotus and Sopranos, respectively. My job was head writer, liaison or ambassador to the cast from the writers, and a million other little chief cook and bottle washer jobs that you, if you did them well, you inserted yourself. I loved being in the editing room, but by and large, it was it wasn't ceremonial. It was hands on, but I did a lot of things. And I did one thing, which was to make sure that we had the script and it was good and it was ready and the actors had read it and given their notes. Because Blue Bloods was what they call a closed end procedural, each plot had to wrap up at the end of each episode. So we didn't arc the season the way you would arc, let's say, White Lotus. You got to know where everything's going. Two follows one and three follows two. We could be seen in any given order. So the only planning or the planning, and there was a lot of it, was how do we grow these characters? What happens to them? It will be serviced partly by plot, but that's the one season long thing that we could do. We're going to take this person from being angry and lonely to being slightly less angry and lonely, or from being just plain lonely to being in love and in a relationship. In the case of My Aim Is True, that ended with Will Estes and Vanessa Ray's characters announcing their engagement, I believe. Wasn't that the end?
They take their vows at the famous Sunday dinner.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well, so one of the questions I have then is, it's kind of like, I guess Hill Street Blues might have been the model for the kind of show that Blue Bloods is. That is, you have each episode has a self-contained story, but there are overarching stories that go through the whole.
Yeah. I think you tuned into, I honestly, and I love them both, Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue. I couldn't really tell you the plots. I certainly couldn't tell you, oh, that great action sequence where the squad car ran through the vegetable vendor's cart. It was all about those characters and their relationships and their personal lives. And that's where Blue Bloods lived.
And that's what you remember. So how do you make a decision, say, like with the kids? You had a wonderful actor with Sammy Gale. And I was so surprised because, you know, she was a little girl when the show started. Then she developed a really wonderful actress. And then you sort of wrote her out of the show. Was that because what was it because of?
Well, it was partly real life. She went off to college and graduated college, and it was partly real estate. Because, and for Sammy Gale, and I don't blame her, she came to me and us and said, where are my stories? And I took a hard look at it along with my writer colleagues. And we thought, we only have 43 minutes of real estate. We already had four stories a week that we had to tell. So I was honest with her. I said, I can tell you that you will have some stories, but I can't tell you that I can build out another avenue on this show for the Nikki Boyle stories.
Yeah.
And she said, okay, well, you know, hopefully I'll come back once in a while. But in my memory, it was amicable. I wished I could have done more with her, but again, I had, we had a big cast.
Spinoff. What about the death of his wife? I can't remember the characters' names suddenly, but
Linda Reagan. Linda. Yes, Linda. That was a difficult little period there. It's been talked about. I know it's been in the press because I've read it on my phone. She after season whatever it was, I'll say six or five, ended. There was a unsuccessful negotiation between her and her reps and CBS television studios, and she wasn't coming back. And we didn't have any, we didn't know that when we wrapped up the previous season, and we didn't have her for the new one. So it was a Band-Aid to try to write her off, obviously not having, like, she left her husband and kids to go off with the Cabana Boy or something. We killed her off in a vaguely Blue Bloods-y kind of way. But, yeah. You know, she died on the negotiating table, as they say.
That's, those things are very interesting to the viewer who gets invested in these characters and wonders, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I have another question, Kevin Wade, about Blue Bloods. You know, everything is political nowadays. And many people have said to me, Blue Bloods, that's a Republican show.
I never quite knew what to do with that because I know the writers very well. And it was, they were just, everybody came from different backgrounds. We actually never talked about our politics, or very rarely. And we were never trying to be political with the show. That being said, we weren't stupid. We knew that there was large chunks of the run of that show where cops were persona non grata, where a really bad apple cop had taken over the national conversation by what he did. By the wall of blue or the back the blue were associated with the writer side of the aisle. I had kind of one idea that we brought through all the seasons, which was, if you're going to build a soapbox, say, for the cops or for Catholic conservatives or for Irish or whatever it is, you have to tell a story that builds a soapbox of equal dimensions for the other side, for the Black Baptist teacher or the city council member or whatever it is that opposes that thing, that says you're hypocrites or your brutality or whatever it is. That's all we tried to do. So as to how it was perceived, that was well beyond my bailiwick.
when you're done with I guess it's kind of a treadmill, right? Because as soon as you're done, you have to immediately start thinking about the following week and keep going. Until now it's finally over. Did you watch each episode as it aired?
I watched each episode. By the time it aired, I'd seen it maybe 5 or 6 times. Because I did have, eventually I had the final edit, and I loved being with Mark Snow, the composer, and doing the music cues. I did 3 or 4 edits, did the studio's notes edits, and then I would have Mark, and I went to the mix a couple of times. It was just, I loved I was the guy who could be the cop that says, this is on at 10 o'clock on Friday night. It has a job to do, which is to entertain, not to preach, which is not to virtue signal. It's purely to entertain. And by 11 to 11, it needed certain elements that I felt the audience needed, that the guy and his wife or whatever it was who had tuned in, they had a set of expectations that I sat in that chair in that dark editing room and tried to meet.
And then they had to have a meal, a Sunday dinner.
Some
point in every episode.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Was it hard to shoehorn it in?
Yeah, what are they going to fight about this week? Or, you know, and I think every single writer who ever passed through there did at least one where it was just a recreation of his own or her own family dynamic, whether as a kid or current day. We just sort of went, you know, the other day, let's put that in. That sounds good. You know, so we did a lot of that.
Well, there are not many shows that I can think of that have been on the air, that were on the air for 14 years with basically the same cast. And with a high level of quality throughout. So I've watched every episode, so I know. So congratulations on Blue Bloods, Kevin Wade. And it's interesting for you because people don't think, oh, that's Kevin Wade's show. I mean, it's Tom Selleck's show or whatever. They don't think about you.
No, nor should they. It was, to be fair, it was created by Leonard Goldberg, who was a wonderful, brilliant television and movie producer going back to the early 70s and had done a bunch of shows with a guy named Aaron Spelling, then was head of ABC for a while. And I knew him because he was head of Fox when he greenlighted Working Girl. So he was the guy who actually put Working Girl up on the screens in terms of the studio. And brilliant man. And he had this idea of three generations and they would have dinner. And he very specifically thought of the that famous painting with bringing the turkey to the table. Why the guy's is Norman Rockwell.
Yes.
That to him was, he said, that's this show in his head, is that idea of Americana where everybody can sit at the table and disagree and do this and that, but you come back the following week and you do it over again.
I think you had good actors too, and I think they you watched them grow as actors as the show progressed. Not just the kids, but the adults too, got to be better actors.
The adults grew, and we could write to their strengths. We could write to dynamics. I mean, once I think it was midway through the run, or maybe a little before that, when Steve Sciarippa joined, and all of a sudden we had the statuesque, beautiful Bridget Moynihan with Steve Sciarippa from The Sopranos. And we thought, well, it looks like Laurel and Hardy if you squint a little bit. There's a kind of a beanpole and a round guy. And we had great fun with that. And then Steve grew into that, and Bridget grew into that, and she was able to bring her razor-sharp sense of humor to it. I think we were able to some extent to do that with all of them.
I think so, too. We're talking with Kevin Wade, and we have just been talking about his time working on Blue Bloods, but because there was a writer's strike a couple of years ago, now he's written a novel, and the novel is called Johnny Careless. You know, it's a mystery, and so we don't want to give too much away, but why don't you set it up for readers? What do you want people to know?
Is this okay? But we could both do it. We've done our duty. You're welcome, Macmillan Publishing. I'm sorry, I talked right through your question.
All right. Because it's a mystery, you don't want to give too much away. So tell readers, potential readers, what they might want to know going into Johnny Careless.
So the North Shore of Long Island has a kind of upstairs, downstairs, haves and have-nots geography. And that was first sort of put forth 100 years ago in The Great Gatsby. And it's about a young man named Jeep Mullane, grows up the son of a cop in the one sort of working class village in this area. And he becomes friends with, among other people, a guy named Johnny Chambliss, who is a wealthy, handsome, every privilege in the world. And they become pals, and eventually Jeep goes off to follow in his father's footsteps as an NYPD cop, and bounces off after a traumatic case, comes back and takes the job as the local police chief where he grew up. And on the second page, it's not a spoiler because it's page two, his good friend from childhood washes up dead on the beach. Everybody says it looks like a boating accident, and Jeep Mullane says, I think there's something more, and it starts there. But it's as much about the story of this friendship over 23 years, I think, is the timeline, but also about what it's like to be around people, tribes, customs, where you always feel like you have your nose pressed to the glass, and life is more interesting and richer and wittier and funnier inside the party you're not invited to. And that's kind of Jeep's role in life. And in this case, he has to figure these folks out.
Well, I'm sure that he doesn't have a lot of friends that get killed, but will there be more?
It will if it's a series. Cause
yeah, will there be more Jeep stories? That's what I want to know. He seems like he could be a good ongoing character. And do you see more novels coming in the Jeep series?
Not to leave this room, but I'm in the middle of writing a second one. And so it's I pitched it and gave some chapters, and Macmillan very generously and actually betting ordered a second version. So
fantastic. That's wonderful. Good. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. One of the things I love about your writing is there's a lot of pop culture references In fact, you even mentioned Blue Bloods in Johnny.
Sure. Whatever's on the desk goes into the thing, man.
Looney Tunes get mentioned a lot. Or character. Yeah. Everybody is a character in a Looney Tune. Are you? There wasn't a whole lot of pop culture references in Blue Bloods. I guess because you don't want to mention other things on a television show.
You know, that's an and I tried whatever the ones I didn't try or not try. I just put them in as they came up. It is a trap because for something like Blue Bloods, those run back to 2011, 2010. But in success, they live on. Forever. So
my mom gets a station that only shows episodes of Blue Bloods.
I paid for my ham sandwich at lunch today. That's they date you, you know. So if you start having Dua Lipa jokes or references, hopefully someday somebody's going to read it and go, "What is that?" You know. If it's too current, it just doesn't. So I always thought that Raymond Chandler kind of made up his own slang. If you read Raymond Chandler and enjoy it, but you know, the man had more chins than the Hong Kong phone book or whatever. People didn't talk like that, even then, I'm guessing. And frails didn't have pins that ran right up to their neck. But he created a slang, a kind of hard-boiled thing. I thought, well, that's one answer, is you just create your own cultural references. They're fake, but they last through time.
I'm sure there's a lot of differences between writing a novel and writing for television. But one is that you don't have a censor telling you, oh, you can't use the F word.
That's true. You have you can use language as you want to. I suppose you could be as graphic, and you can be, because I've read those books. You can be graphic sexually.
There's a little bit of sex in Johnny Carey.
There's a tiny, yeah. It's I won't spoil it for the folks. Page 179. But you do it in the modern culture. You're going to have a sensitivity read. Somebody is going to read it and point out things that may offend people. So it's not traditional censorship in terms of blue laws or language, but you do have people are aware of the landscape out there and making it suitable for public consumption. I didn't run afoul much because it's not what I do.
You know, another Blue Bloods question, the era in which Blue Bloods ran was the era of the, you know, the sort of death of network television. I mean, people really watched network television in 2010, and they don't watch it now. And most kids have no idea what you're talking about when you talk about network television.
I know, yeah.
And was there less pressure as the show went on because people wanted? The networks wanted people to watch television, so they didn't say, oh, you can't do that. It was sort of like, go ahead and do that? Or,
you know, I can only speak from the chair I sat in. As Blue Bloods went on, we got less and less. We'd hear from them once in a while. You know, we'd hear from them every episode, but it was 5 minutes. We were doing what we did in New York. All of us were in New York, and so a couple of thousand miles away, and it was working. We won 10 o'clock on Friday night. We won all of Friday night for most of the run of the show. So, we weren't directed one way or another as long as the ratings were high. And the ratings were high starting with the third season of the show. It was a top 10 show, then a top 5 show, and it stayed there.
What was the decision to end the show? Was that yours, Tom Selleck's? Who decided to end it?
No, that was CBS's. They felt it had become too expensive. And I think that as you mentioned, the model was changing, and the model of a very expensive show on Friday night at 10. Friday night at 10 at the end, I think the very last show had extraordinary ratings of 6.5 million people. A normal rating on Friday night in season 3 was 12.5 million people. And then going from there in terms, but as DVRs and streaming took over, it became a different model, and they just felt it was too expensive to do. and apparently continue to. They canceled two FBIs and SWAT this week, I believe.
Wow. So Dick Wolf has gotten a couple of cancellations too.
Even Dick Wolf, which is not going to play well, I'm sure.
There was an episode, I think it was the beginning, the 21st season of Special Victims Unit broke the record of Gunsmoke of having been the longest running dramatic. And in the opening scene of that show, they were in a bar and Gunsmoke was playing on the TV.
Good for them. That may be Warren Light, who is an acquaintance of mine, who's a wonderful writer and a pretty witty guy. Or it may be Marischka. So that's pretty great. Or maybe it's Dick Wolf. I should give credit where credit is due. Gunsmoke, by the way, have you watched a Gunsmoke
I
in
have
the
watched it
oh,
many
here?
times. Yeah, I'm a
He
Gunsmoke fan.
walks into a saloon and they talk for like 40 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of talking. Well,
It's a very different model.
it's originally a radio program, so
But the exposition, they don't even pretend to move around location. It's they just talk about the plot.
Well, you have a lot of action in Blue Bloods. It takes place on the streets of Manhattan and other boroughs. That must have been difficult to negotiate. How did that work?
We had a great locations crew. We had great producers. The mayor's office of motion pictures and television does a very good job of serving two masters, the people who want to shoot there and put New York up on screens, and the people who profit, whether it's hotels and restaurants and this and that, and the ripple out in the into the economy of shooting there. We just made it work. It's fun to shoot in New York, and three blocks away is the greatest pool of acting talent on the face of the earth. So,
Most shows like that, they go to wherever the show takes place and they shoot a bunch of scenes and then they do it all in Burbank.
yeah, there's a lot of that. Yep.
But where did you shoot the interiors
We
in
had five sound stages in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, a campus we shared with a number of other shows over the years. It was called Broadway Stages, and that's where we shot. So we'd shoot 8 days per episode, 5 days out on location, maybe four, and three or four on our stages. The dining room, Frank's office, the squad room, all that stuff.
I was watching it the other night, as I told you, and I was thinking about the office, Frank's office. It's like every little detail in that office is like, oh, somebody put that there so that we would see it. And
Yep.
it's very the sets were very detailed. Was there somebody's that was somebody's job?
The art director and the set decorators, we once and you're right, and their house and everything else, but I went setting it, and the plot I don't remember, but there was the dead guy was a hoarder, and we were herd of hoarders. So I go to this, we built it on one of our stages, and I go into the hoarder's apartment and I start looking around. And they'd sourced Life magazines from the 70s. They'd stuff that you would never you'd have to be looking at it frame by frame at home, but there it was, for the sake of the people playing the detectives and the actors who were involved in the story. It was brilliant. They did that all the time. Mario Ventania, I'll give him a shout out. He's that guy.
Well, Johnny Careless has a lot of wonderful atmosphere and details, and it's also shot. It's also presented in a non-linear way. That is, we go back and forth in time.
Yeah.
How did you keep track of everything? Do you have like index cards or what?
No, I unfortunately, as it turned out, because I think it made for more work. All my writing life, I've been used to outlining stuff. Certainly, when you write movies and television, it's very important to write because they the structure is like sonnets. It's very specific. I thought of a novel, and I read a thing where Elmore Leonard said, "I don't outline my books. I go the plot goes where the characters tell me to take it." And I thought, "Well, I'll do that." And then when I started, I thought, "Well, we would know the characters and invest in them even more if we watch them grow. If we watch their relationship grow in front of our eyes, as we watched how one brokenhearted was trying to find out what in fact happened to his friend and alternated those. So it was a way of trying to get the reader invested. Character driven is the cliche of it, but I try to write character driven stuff, and I'm not a great plot guy. I mean, I think the plot of Johnny Careless is fine, but I really needed to lean in on the character stuff.
And you did very well,
Thanks.
and I'm anxious for whatever the next Jeep series stories will be. I think there'll be many of them. I have an idea. I think you should write so out in California, Nikki, she's out there. She graduates from what I don't know what she decided to do, and somehow she gets involved in a crime. I think would you be allowed to use the characters of Blue Bloods to write a Blue Bloods spin-off novel if you wanted?
I don't know. I'd have to ask them, but I think that Blue Blood, you know, it's funny because after it's not funny, it's natural that after it ended, there was a lot of talk about a Blue Blood spinoff or this or that or the other thing. And Blue Bloods was never NCIS or CSI. It was always all those people. It wasn't one. Yes, Tom Selleck was the star, the face on the bus, and the patriarch of that ensemble cast. But the show, it seems to me, and from all the reaction I've gotten about it over the years, it was all of them. It was the whole ball of wax. So that part is, I don't think you're going to recreate that. And so I take what I'm doing now as, I don't know. I'll send you a check for the Nikki Reagan idea.
All right.
Well, I'll take an option on it.
That's mine. That's mine. So do you think now you will be a novelist and not work in television, or are you just going to see what happens?
I'm just going to see what happens. I mean, look, candidly, and we're speaking honestly, and I'm an old pale male. Television and movies are not like, God, where's Kevin Wade? We need him for the new thing. It's just the way the business has always worked, but certainly works now. I'm very happy sitting in my room making stuff up again. So for now.
When you go to the movies or watch films or television, do you think there's a generational change in tastes that is leaving you behind? You think, oh, why do they like that?
Well, I watch stuff. I watched Anora, and then I in the movie theater, and God bless them on the, especially that crew and a couple of others on the awards show, for featuring like go to the movies, movie building. I think someone did that joke. I watched Anora and I completely got it. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I think part of that reason was I could love it. And my son could love it. And we could all go, okay, this is Pretty Woman with the syrup hosed off it. So the storytelling thing is there from the past, but it was completely reinvented.
Yeah. So you didn't say, what is all of this? This doesn't make any sense. You didn't.
Why is she naked? And she keeps swearing all the time.
There was a lot of yelling. It's a very noisy movie.
Yes, it certainly was.
But I do think young people are noisier than we used to be. Well, I don't think we were so noisy when we were younger.
I've heard that you were very noisy. I myself was quiet and a good Catholic boy.
Well, I hope everyone will want to run out and buy Johnny Careless. It's a really, really great book. And it fits right in with all the great work that you have done. Kevin Wade is my guest, and thanks so much for spending some time.
It's a pleasure talking to you. I had a great time. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.